Here's a look at our top stories this hour. Russia announces new retaliatory measures against Moscow-based British media after London imposes sanctions on Russian news outlets. Yemen's former Saudi-backed president announces the establishment of a presidential leadership council and transfers his powers to it. Also ahead, Syria condemns Israeli forces' repeated attacks on Palestinians across the occupied territories, calling on the international community to take immediate action to stop the regime's crimes. Hello and welcome. We are coming to you live from the Iranian capital, Tehran. This is World News. Thank you for joining us. 43 days into Russia's military offensive in Ukraine, there are reports of fresh Russian strikes against the cities of Mariupol and Kharkiv. Ukrainian officials say they're trying to help residents to evacuate Mariupol. The port city remains one of the worst affected areas, with its mayor warning that the situation there has now gone beyond a humanitarian disaster. Calls for evacuation are also underway in the eastern Luhansk region, where an acid tank exploded on Tuesday. Kyiv and pro-Russian forces are blaming each other for the incident. Other developments in eastern Ukraine include Russia's bombardment of the city of Kramatorsk, where an empty school was damaged. Meanwhile, Russia says its guards have been targeted in Kursk, a city located on its western border with Ukraine. Russia says it will take further measures against Moscow-based British media after London imposed sanctions against Russian news outlets. Russia's foreign ministry spokesperson says the move is in response to, quote, British oppression of Russian media. This after London announced sanctions on 14 Russian people and entities, including the state media organizations behind the RT and Sputnik news channels. The spokesperson emphasized that symmetrical measures against British media in Russia, quote, have been and will be taken. Russia blocked the website of Britain's BBC on March 16 in what was described by Moscow as the beginning of its response to West's information war. Iran's foreign minister has reiterated the Islamic Republic's opposition to the war in Ukraine, calling for a political solution to the ongoing crisis. Hossein Amir Abdullahian also rejected the West's policy of imposing sanctions on other countries. He made the comments in a phone call with Hungarian Foreign Minister Peter Szijjártó. The call came after the recent general election in Hungary, in which Prime Minister Viktor Orban clinched a landslide victory. Tehran had previously said that the Ukrainian crisis is rooted in the expansionist policy of the U.S.-led NATO military alliance. Record disinterest in the French election may have taken a dramatic turn. New polls show the far right is now in a dead heat with the incumbent Emmanuel Macron. Many have pointed to Macron's lack of engagement in the campaign as a reason for his lost lead. Rami Mazahiri has more from Paris.
The latest voter polls in France have shown an almost total evaporation of a once sizable lead for President Emmanuel Macron. His edge over 2017's far-right runner-up, Marine Le Pen, is now down to just 3 points in a hypothetical second round, making the race a dead heat. France goes to the ballot box for the first round in just a few days on April 10th. Recent missteps by Macron may have alienated a French electorate, which featured a 40% undecided rate just last week. Macron is being openly accused of trying to run from his record by hiding behind the unrest in Ukraine. He has refused to join any debate before the second round vote and has barely campaigned in France. With Macron's refusal, there was no typical first round debate between the 11 presidential hopefuls. Instead, every candidate sat down for a highly anticipated televised grilling from journalists, all except Macron. His decision has come under harsh scrutiny as being anti-democratic.
It just shows how much Macron is just like all the other politicians, thinking only of himself. He knows that he did not implement the change that he'd promised, and that's why he can't face anyone. I may submit a blank ballot or vote for the riskiest candidate. That may be the only way to change things.
Macron, who did not hold his first press conference until more than 2 years into his term, has long been criticized as displaying a monarchical aloofness and an authoritarian style of governance. The election campaign has been dominated by xenophobia, which then created major disinterest and now worries of record abstention. With the left still running in third place, a candidate with many far-right policies seems certain to take office.
The right wing has been exploded into different sections, and both Macron's section and Le Pen's section are stable. 2017 destroyed the other parties and also the influence of society's intermediaries, such as unions and NGOs. And maybe we'll say later that this was a bad thing, but I'm not really interested in this election until the second round.
The huge recent victory of Le Pen's counterpart in Hungary has many wondering if polls have similarly underestimated the right nationalist candidate in France. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris. No.
Yemen's former Saudi-backed president, Abdurrabba Mansour Hadi, announces the establishment of a so-called presidential leadership council. The council is supposed to run the country's political, military, and security affairs. Now, in order to get more on this, we have Yusuf Mowry on the line from Detroit. He is a Yemeni journalist and political analyst. Yusuf, thank you for joining us, and thank you for your time. Given the truce that is first of its kind since 2016, where do you think this decision, sacking the former vice president and transferring Mansour Hadi's powers to what is called a presidential leadership council, stand in the current climate?
There is no ceding of power. There is no presidential council. There is no, quote unquote, legit Yemeni president as far as the Sana'a government is concerned. Abdurrabba Mansour Hadi cannot cede power if he simply does not have power. In fact, Abdurrabba Mansour Hadi's regime, they wouldn't even be able to issue a speeding ticket to an 80-year-old grandma, let alone dictate the political policies of the country. This is as far as the Yemeni people are concerned and the Sana'a government, because what's clear is that those who are able to exert any type of influence are the parties that are on the ground, is Ansar Allah-backed government and the forces loyal to Saudi Arabia in the province of Madib, in the province of Taiz. These are the only acting parties in the country who can exert some type of influence in deciding the fate of the political affairs of the country. Nothing Abdurrabba Mansour does or this newly established presidential council will have any impact on the affairs that are happening in Yemen. Abdurrabba Mansour Hadi can declare himself to be a pelican and nobody would even think twice about it the next day, because he's simply out of the picture, and he can try to reshuffle his regime, his cabinet, any way he wants to. It's not going to have any impact on what's happening in reality and what's occurring on the ground. According to Ansar Allah and according to a lot of their officials who are tweeting on Twitter, this war is between two parties, and that is the Sana'a government led by Ansar Allah and Saudi Arabia. And they view this as just another plan, another plot, another scheme by Saudi Arabia to try to somehow, some way gain leverage and try to establish some type of legitimacy for the regime of Abdurrabba Mansour Hadi, even though there's cosmetic changes according to this latest declaration by
Yusuf, that's exactly my question. How does it provide Saudi Arabia with legitimacy?
No, Saudi Arabia is basically, and this is according to Ansar Allah, they're trying to evade the shame of this 7 year of war that has just led to their humiliation in terms of military strategy. Because Ansar Allah is still in power, they're still able to launch ballistic missiles into Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia is trying to play the middle ground now. They're trying to parade themselves or present themselves as the peacemakers. And Saudi Arabia is trying to sell this pitch that they're trying to establish peace between Ansar Allah and the Hadi-backed government. And that's a pitch that a lot of people are not buying, because for the simple fact is, people know that Abdurrabba Mansour Hadi's regime is loyal and has taken its orders from Saudi Arabia. And the fact of the matter is, the war is between Saudi Arabia and Yemen. It's Saudi Arabia who's been bombing every single province in Yemen. It's Saudi Arabia who's responsible for the strangling blockade that has resulted into the deaths of tens of thousands of innocent Yemenis. It's not the Hadi government. The Hadi government does not exist in the element chart when it comes to the conflict in Yemen. So, and this is what Ansar Allah is trying to point out to the international community is that the war is between Yemen and Saudi Arabia, and negotiations need to be conducted with Saudi Arabia. Any peace deal, any truce agreement that is going to be implemented needs to be established between Yemen and Saudi Arabia. And so this latest declaration by Abd Rabbu Mansour Hadi is not going to have any impact on the ground. It's not going to change the balance of power in Yemen. As far as Ansar Allah government is concerned, this is nothing but just another puppet show.
Yusuf, I absolutely enjoyed your analysis there. Thank you so much for joining us. That was Yusuf Mowry, a Yemeni journalist and political analyst, speaking to us from Detroit. Moving on, the Saudi-led coalition seizes another Yemeni-bound fuel ship despite a two-month truce brokered by the United Nations. The Yemen Petroleum Company says the seizure of the oil vessel Daytona is in violation of the ceasefire agreed before the holy month of Ramadan. The company says the vessel had been inspected and obtained a UN clearance to enter the Yemeni port, but it says the tanker was forced to change its route and taken to a port in Saudi Arabia's Jizan region. This brings to three the number of fuel ships that have been confiscated by Riyadh since last year. Yemen is grappling with a deteriorating humanitarian crisis due to a relentless bombing campaign and blockade by Saudi Arabia, along with some of its regional allies since 2015. Hundreds of thousands of Yemenis, mostly civilians, have been killed and millions more displaced over the past 7 years. Syria has condemned Israeli forces' repeated attacks on Palestinians across the occupied territories, calling on the international community to stop the regime's crimes immediately. In an official statement, the Syrian Foreign Ministry called Israel's acts of aggression against the Palestinian people a crime that contravenes the international law and relevant UN resolutions. Reaffirming its support for Palestinian people, Syria called on the international community to fulfill its responsibility toward them. The statement came as the regime in Tel Aviv continues its crackdown on Palestinians during the holy month of Ramadan. The regime's forces have arrested a large number of Palestinians in occupied East Al-Quds and have frequently desecrated Al-Aqsa Mosque compound. Palestinian resistance movements have warned Israel against its acts of aggression, particularly during the month of Ramadan. And the Israeli Prime Minister's party has lost its majority in parliament after a key lawmaker quit the ruling coalition. Chairwoman of the ruling coalition, Idit Selman, has, in a surprise move, resigned over a religious dispute. Her resignation has left the alliance with only 60 seats, effectively ending its parliamentary majority. Opposition figures have welcomed her move. The issue has also raised the possibility of new elections, less than a year after Prime Minister Naftali Bennett's cabinet took office. If that happens, it will be Israel's fifth elections in more than 2 years. Bennett's coalition, which was formed last year to unseat Benjamin Netanyahu, consists of 8 political parties. Our Roman Lopez correspondent Mona Kandil says the resignation of Idil Silman was an under-the-table deal between her and former Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu.
According to the Israeli media, Silman said her pretext was a memo the Minister of Health sent to Israeli regime hospital in a few days ago, instructing them to uphold a high court ruling allowing people to bring what's called leavened foods into hospitals in the coming Passover. But the real reason, according to experts, it's a, let's say, her final decision was taken, it's because of a political deal that she reached with the a former Israeli Prime Minister, opposition leader Benjamin Netanyahu, who promised her that if she quits, and then they will go to next Israeli elections, and that in case the Likud in the Likud next in the next election would won the elections and form the next regime or cabinet, she will be receiving the position of the health minister in the next Israeli regime.
The head of the Atomic Energy Organization of Iran blames the West for failing to condemn Israel's acts of sabotage against the Islamic Republic.
The Zionist regime produces fake documents, carries out acts of sabotage, including industrial sabotage and terrorist operations. Unfortunately, such acts not only are not condemned or confronted, but are welcomed. Naturally, this is a battle between wrong and right, which remains in place. We follow our goals and will not back down.
Islami also touched upon the issue of cooperation between Tehran and the International Atomic Energy Agency, the IAEA. He said Iran handed over documents related to outstanding issues to the watchdog on March 20th. He added the body is still reviewing the documents and its representatives will probably travel to Iran for further talks and preparing a final report. Iran demands the IAEA end its investigations into uranium particles. The agency claims have been found at three undeclared sites. Last month, Iran and the IAEA agreed to a three-month plan to resolve the issue arising from such claims. Political commentator David Yahubian says a review of Israeli officials' words and deeds on a daily basis shows that the regime is bent on torpedoing the 2015 deal known as the JCPOA.
It's clear to any observer that, and I mean of not just the process, the JCPOA, the U.S. pullout, maximum pressure, et cetera, but Israel's deeds and its words almost on a daily basis, that Israel is determined to wreck the JCPOA, to either say ruin the agreement or to hinder the return by the signatories to full compliance. And so it has engaged in repeated acts of terrorism, repeated acts of industrial sabotage. It has produced troves of fake documents. And most importantly, again, it has repeatedly threatened to take military action, direct kinetic action against Iran's legal nuclear energy, civilian nuclear energy facilities.
This is IRIB English Radio. With you early in the morning. With you at midday. With you till the night's end. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Project Nimbus has ignited a secretive war involving top Zionist regime army generals, all vying for a share in the profit, and whetted the appetite of many other international tech companies. Stay with us for an article in this regard written by Ramzi Barood, journalist. This article is published under the heading Project Nimbus, How Amazon and Google Made Billions from Zionist Regime Occupation. Here's more. We are anonymous because we fear retaliation. This sentence was part of a letter signed by 500 Google employees last October, in which they decried their company's direct support for the Zionist regime. In their letter, the signatories protested a $1.2 billion contract between Google, Amazon Web Services, AWS, and the Zionist regime, which provides cloud services for the Zionist regime's military that allows for further surveillance of an unlawful data collection on Palestinians and facilitates expansion of the Zionist regime's illegal settlements on Palestinian land. This is called Project Nimbus. The project was announced in 2018 and went into effect in May 2021, in the first week of the Zionist regime's war on besieged Gaza, which killed over 250 Palestinians and wounded many more. The Google employees were not only disturbed by the fact that, by entering into this agreement with the Zionist regime, their company became directly involved in the Zionist regime's occupation of Palestine, but were equally outraged by the disturbing pattern of militarization that saw similar contracts between Google, Amazon, Microsoft, and other tech giants, with the U.S. military, immigration and customs enforcement, and other policing agencies. In an article published in The Nation magazine in June, three respected U.S. academics have revealed the financial component of Amazon's decision to get involved in such an immoral business, arguing that such military-linked contracts have become a major source of profit for Amazon. It is estimated, according to the article, that AWS alone was responsible for 60% of Amazon's profits in 2020. The slogan, "People before profit," cannot be any more appropriate than in the Palestinian context, and neither Google nor Amazon can claim ignorance. The Zionist regime's occupation of Palestine has been in place for decades, and numerous United Nations resolutions have condemned the Zionist regime for its occupation, colonial expansion, and violence against Palestinians. If all of that was not enough to wane the enthusiasm of Google and Amazon to engage in projects that specially aimed at protecting the Zionist regime's security, read Continued Occupation of Palestine, a damning report by the Zionist regime's largest human rights group, should have served as that wake-up call. B'Tselem declared Israel an apartheid regime in January 2021. The international rights group Human Rights Watch followed suit in April, also denouncing the Zionist regime's apartheid. That was only a few weeks before Project Nimbus was declared. It was as if Google and Amazon were purposely declaring their support of apartheid. The fact that the project was signed during the Zionist regime's war on Gaza speaks volumes about two tech giants' complete disregard of international law, human rights, and the very freedom of the Palestinian people. It gets worse. On March 15th, hundreds of Google workers signed a petition protesting the firing of one of their colleagues, Ariel Koren, who was active in generating the October letter in protest of Project Nimbus. Koren was the product marketing manager at Google for education and has worked for the company for 6 years. However, she was the kind of employee who was not welcomed by the likes of Google, as the company is now directly involved with various military and security projects. Koren said in a statement last October, "For me, as a Jewish employee of Google, I feel a deep sense of intense moral responsibility. When you work in a company, you have the right to be accountable and responsible for the way that your labor is actually being used." Google quickly retaliated to that seemingly outrageous statement. The following month, Koren's manager presented her with an ultimatum: move to Brazil or lose her position. Eventually, she was driven out of the company. Koren was not the first Google or Amazon employee to be fired for standing up for a good cause, nor would sadly be the last. In the age of militarism, surveillance, unwarranted facial recognition and censorship, speaking one's mind and daring to fight for human rights and other basic freedoms is no longer an option. Amazon's warehouses can be as bad or even worse than a typical sweatshop. Amazon, which stands accused of numerous violations of worker rights, including its engagement in union busting, is not expected to reverse course anytime soon, especially when so much profits are at stake. But profits generated from market monopoly, mistreatment of workers, or other misconducts are different from profits generated from contributing directly to war crimes and crimes against humanity. Though human rights violations should be shunned everywhere, regardless of their context, the Zionist regime war on the Palestinian people, now with the direct help of such companies, remains one of the gravest injustices that continue to scar the consciousness of humankind. No amount of Google justification or Amazon rationalization can change the fact that they are facilitating the Zionist regime's wars in Palestine.
Food for thought.
Salam, and let us ponder on what the commander of the faithful, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace upon him, has quoted from his cousin, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, on the rules of fasting. Whoever fasts during the month of Ramadan out of faith and seeking Allah's pleasure and guards his ears, eyes, and tongue from harming people, Allah will accept his fasting and forgive his past sins.
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
This is A to Z. An Introduction to Islamic Lifestyle. Today's lesson, the month of sacrifice. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of Allah, the most beneficent, the most merciful. Dear brothers and sisters, assalamu alaikum. Peace and blessings of Allah be upon you all. This is A to Z, coming to you from IRIB English Radio, and I'm your host, Ali. The Prophet of Allah, Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam, once cried. Imam Ali alayhi salam asked him, O Messenger of Allah, what made you cry? The Prophet said,
O Ali, I am crying for the injustice that will be done against you in this month. It is as if I see you that while you are praying to your Lord, the most wretched of mankind struck you with a sword on your head, so that its blood colored your beard. Imam Ali alayhi salam asked, O Messenger of Allah, will this happen while I am at peace with my faith? Brothers and sisters, look at this narration. Look at what Imam Ali alayhi salam is saying. Look at what his concern is. See, Imam Ali alayhi salam did not ask whether, you know, my kids are going to be okay after I get martyred. Imam Ali alayhi salam did not ask whether, you know, my belongings, what's going to happen to them? Is my wife going to be okay? You know, Imam Ali alayhi salam was not concerned primarily about any of these things. The first and foremost question the commander of the faithful, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib alayhi salam, asked was whether my faith would be intact at that time. This is such a lesson for all of us that we cannot ignore the importance of solid faith in Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, solid faith in the deen of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, solid faith in Quran, in Ahlul Bayt, and the Prophet of Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, that even with such a news, where Imam Ali alayhi salam is being told that in this particular month you're going to be martyred and you're going to have to face this oppression by the most wretched people, Imam Ali alayhi salam is not concerned about anything else before his faith. Brothers and sisters, if we start looking at our lives like this, every action that we carry out throughout our lives, that whether it is going to harm my faith or not, whether it is going to be deteriorating for my faith or not, this is something what is expected from the believers in the commander of the believers. Welcome back, dear listeners. We gave you a quick story about the sacrifice in this blessed month of Ramadan, the sacrifice of Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib. The Prophet of Allah is informing Imam Ali alayhi salam about his own martyrdom. Imam Ali alayhi salam turns back and asks a question, which is very surprising for many of us. Of course, not for Imam Ali alayhi salam and these greats, but for people like myself, it's very surprising that the question he asks is whether my faith is going to be intact or not. You want to listen to the reply of the Holy Prophet? The Prophet replied, "You will be at peace with your faith, O Ali. Whoever kills you is as if he has killed me. Whoever hates you is as if he hates me. Whoever curses you is as if he has cursed me, because you are to me like my own soul. Your soul is from my soul, and your nature is from my nature. Verily, Almighty Allah created me and you. Then he selected me and you, and chose me for prophethood, and chose you for imamat. So whosoever rejects your imamah, he has indeed rejected my prophethood. O Ali, you are my heir, the father of my descendants, the husband of my daughter, and my successor to my community in my life as well as in my death. Your command is my command, and your prohibition is my prohibition. I swear by the one who raised me as the prophet and made me the best of creation, you indeed are the proof of Allah upon his creation, trustee of his secret and his vicegerent towards his servants." Look how beautifully the Prophet of Allah explained the status of Ali ibn Abi Talib alayhi salam, who was martyred in the blessed month of Ramadan at the hands of the wretched, the most wretched people on the face of the planet Earth at that time. Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, thank you very much for staying with us till the end of today's episode of A to Z. Don't forget to log on to our website at parstoday.com, Call of Islam page. We leave you all in the care of Allah. Till next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
News, social news, scientific news, artistic news. With delight.
With neon lights on the floor and walls, pulsing electronic beats, and a glowing red shuttlecock bouncing back and forth, Malaysian badminton court evokes a sci-fi movie set. Shuttle in the Dark is a badminton hall in the iconic Petronas Twin Towers in Kuala Lumpur, Malaysia. It was set up in late 2021 by a sport management company to encourage people to take up the racket sport after 2 years of social restrictions because of the COVID-19 pandemic. Director of INEC Sport Management says the initial goal was to draw sports fans and players back into action.
Our initial goal was how can we encourage and gain back the interest of people to come back and play. And not only those enthusiasts, but then as well the new people who was not able to or never play badminton before. So that's why we come out with this experience called Shuttle in the Dark.
Playing on a futuristic court presents an unusual challenge for athletes as they have to adjust their eyes to the darkness to fly. Badminton is one of the most popular sports in Malaysia and Asia, with a thriving community in the Southeast Asian community. It has produced some of the world's top-ranked players. A zoo in Ireland's capital, Dublin, has unveiled its newest habitat called the Himalayan Hills, a brand new home of the red panda and the snow leopard. Visitors are able to see the red panda's habitat by traveling along the new trail around a rocky edge to an open viewing area. The red pandas are typically climbing, exploring, or munching on bamboo at the top of broad-leafed evergreen trees. The expanded habitat was designed with a red panda's tree-dwelling lifestyle in mind. Also, visitors can gaze up at the 15-meter rocky slope through an impressive panoramic viewing area to spot the snow leopards. These elusive felines are typically nocturnal, so catching a glimpse of one is a rare treat.
Yeah, the animals are settling in well. We've tried to recreate the wild habitat in the Himalayan hills. Both species live quite high up. In case of the snow leopards, up to 5,000 meters on these very steep rocky slopes, which you can see here in the habitat as well. We've tried to use the topology of Dublin Zoo.
The project took a few years to complete. It was halted in 2020 due to the COVID-19 pandemic and massive budget shortages, but was restarted after government funding in 2021. The zoo is part of a protection project for red pandas and snow leopards. These animals are listed as vulnerable due to threats from poaching and severe habitat loss. ancient Pompeii has a new guardian, Spot, a four-legged robot dog that will inspect the ancient Italian city's streets and tunnels to identify structural issues. The robot, designed by the U.S. firm Boston Dynamics, will patrol Pompeii at nighttime. The robot inspects the smallest of spaces and gathers data for planning interventions to fix safety and structural issues. Equipped with a 360-degree camera, Spot will also protect the city's streets from illegal relic hunters who cause structural damage to the ruins by digging tunnels. Pompeii will also have its own eye in the sky, a Leica BLK-2 Fly flying laser scanner capable of autonomously conducting 3D scans of the ruins, helping Spot carry out its tasks. Safeguarding ancient sites from treasure hunters has always been a problem for every country, especially the ancient ones.
A super rare birth has added a cute member to critically endangered Sumatran rhinos of Indonesia. The newborn calf is the sixth born since intensive efforts to breed the species began in the 1980s. The female calf, which doesn't have a name yet, was given birth to by a rhino named Rosa in a sanctuary. Rosa has suffered 8 miscarriages since 2005 when she was brought in from the wild for a breeding program. Fewer than 80 Sumatran rhinos remain in the world, mainly on the Indonesian islands of Sumatra and Borneo. Excessive poaching along with other threats has brought the species to the brink of extinction. The cherry blossom or sakura season in the Japanese capital is a magical experience as trees burst into bloom, dousing the streets with stunning shades of pink. This year, people are enjoying the occasion to the fullest as COVID restrictions are no more there. Thousands gathered in central Tokyo wearing masks, taking pictures and posing for selfies among the trees. Cherry flowers reach full bloom on Sunday, 4 days earlier than usual, according to the Japan Meteorological Agency. The age-old tradition of viewing cherry blossoms typically takes place across the country. The flowers are a national obsession. People flock to parks to hold parties and picnics. However, due to the pandemic, authorities have asked people to refrain from eating and drinking outdoors.
The Light is a bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
Millions of people across the world celebrate Earth Hour, a symbolic Lights Out event that aims to call attention to environmental issues and the necessity of protecting the planet. The annual event encourages people to turn off their non-essential lighting for an hour and take a break from using electronic devices during that period. Earth Hour takes place every year on the last Saturday of March. The theme of this year's event is Shape Our Future and has been celebrated in more than 180 countries, including Greece, France, Thailand, and Iran. The initiative was first introduced in 2007 by the World Wildlife Fund as a grassroots movement for highlighting the collective responsibility of the people towards their environment. An ancient place in Guatemala with special significance for the Mayan culture could be the next entry on the World Heritage List. The historic village known today as the Takalik Abach Archaeological Park was occupied for 1,700 years before it was abandoned and discovered in 1888. It's said to have been home to a pre-Hispanic people. Archaeologists found their way to this mysterious piece of land where they found a series of exotic artifacts and sculptures back in 2008. Guatemala's Minister of Cultural Heritage says this site has a sacred place in the nation's culture.
Tecale Quebec is a sacred place with important links to Guatemala's culture. It's a place that harbors flora and fauna biodiversity and even Mayan spirituality and war is wild. This makes this place highly important within the Mayan culture in Guatemala.
Archaeologists believe the monuments go back to the deep-rooted civilizations of Olmec and Maya in a Central American culture around 400 BC. The government has presented the site to UNESCO, hoping it will be declared a World Heritage Site. A Belgian-British teenager is on a solo flight around the globe that could make him a world record holder. Mark Rutherford started his journey from a small airfield near the Bulgarian capital Sofia on Wednesday. His first destination, the island of Sicily in Italy. From there, he'll fly south to Africa and then around the globe to cross the finish line again in Bulgaria. The 16-year-old pilot says he got his inspiration from his sister.
Egypt's rich history seems to be a gift that keeps on giving. The country has unveiled some exquisite, newly discovered tombs. The pharaonic tombs were found at the Saqqara archaeological site south of Cairo. The site is a big necropolis of Memphis, an ancient capital of Egypt. The graves belonged to a senior royal official, or rather senior royal officials. Some of the graves are engraved with interesting titles such as Steward of the Royal House and Supervisor of the Garden. The tombs are around 4,000 years old, dating back to the Old Kingdom of Egypt.
Iranian families celebrated the ancient tradition of Sizde Bedar, or Nature's Day, by spending some quality time outdoors with family. Yusuf Jalali has the story.
It's Nature's Day in Iran, and parks and countrysides are flooded with families who never miss the chance to spend the final day of Nowruz holidays out with their loved ones. The ancient occasion is called Sizde Bedar. Over the past 2 years, the festival was called off amid the coronavirus pandemic, and it's the first time in 2 years that Sizde Bedar is marked with such a huge crowd.
Because of the coronavirus, people could not go out on Sizde Bedar for 2 years in a row. And this year, the majority are vaccinated and green spaces are jam-packed with picnic goers.
We Iranians have grown up with Sizde Bedar and we never miss it. Thank God we can safely enjoy this amazing tradition this year with all our family members and relatives.
Sizde Bedar means getting rid of number 13. In Persian mythology, 13 is the bad luck number. Now Sizde Bedar is believed to chase away the bad luck and bring good vibes.
Today, we cooked special foods like ash and chicken kebab to eat them for lunch with our family members. We traditionally believe that this day brings bad luck and we must spend it outdoors with joy to get rid of it.
The event is also called the Festival of Nature, and it is an occasion to raise awareness of the need to preserve the environment.
Throughout the history, Iranians have had close relationship with nature, and that's why we have dedicated a special day in our calendar to nature. Before we leave our place here, we clean the environment.
Sizde Bedar is the final day of the two-week celebrations of the Persian New Year, known as Nowruz, which marks the beginning of spring in the Northern Hemisphere. The tradition has been celebrated for some 3,000 years in Iran, Tajikistan, and Afghanistan, among other communities. Everyone must have missed outdoor gatherings after more than 2 years of COVID restrictions. Now that worries over the pandemic have eased to some extent, Sizde Bedar once again reunited Iranians with Mother Nature, with all the good vibes and hope for a world free of the coronavirus. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran. We'll be right back.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/parstodayen. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/parstodayenglish.
In the Limelight.
On the first day of Ramadan, the Zionist regime's forces shot and killed three Palestinians before dawn on April 2nd in occupied Palestine. Please stay with us for an article in this regard written by the staff of Crescent International. This article is published under the heading Zionist occupiers continue killing a spree of Palestinians. Here's the details. On the first day of Ramadan, the Zionist regime forces shot and killed three Palestinians before dawn on April 2nd in occupied Palestine. The killings occurred when the Zionist regime occupation forces ambushed a vehicle near Jenin City. The vehicle carrying three members of Al-Quds Brigades of Islamic Jihad was blocked by a bus full of occupation troops around 2 a.m. near the junction of Araba village. The Zionist special forces jumped out of the bus and started firing at the vehicle carrying the three men. Saeb Abhara, 30, Khalil Tawalba, 24, and Saif Abu Libda, 25, were seriously wounded, but the Zionist regime occupiers blocked Palestinian ambulances from providing medical help. The Palestinian Red Crescent confirmed that the Zionist regime occupiers prevented its ambulances from approaching the location of the incident. The three Palestinians bled to death. The Zionists also withheld their bodies after murdering them in cold blood. The occupation forces alleged that the Palestinians opened fire at them when they attempted to arrest them, which prompted a gunfight. Four Zionist regime troops were wounded. One of them is in critical condition, according to Zionist occupation forces. They also called for reinforcements. Immediately, a large number of Zionist occupation troops swarmed the area, terrorizing Palestinian villagers. Islamic Jihad leader in Jenin, Khadar Adnan, denounced the Zionist regime's aggressors who have been targeting the village for several days. Jenin is being targeted because over the past week, Palestinians have carried out shooting attacks against the Zionists, killing 11 of them. Jenin's resistance has intensified over the last year, causing alarm among the Zionists. This has aroused the Zionist regime's wrath. Only they can kill Palestinians. The oppressed and occupied are not allowed to resist, according to this logic. Islamic Jihad's Al-Quds Brigades issued a statement saying they mourn the death of the three hero fighters. Two of martyrs were from Jenin and one from Tulkarm. 2 days earlier, on March 31st, Zionist regime occupation forces raided Jenin in an attempt to arrest some Palestinians, but the Zionist regime forces were pushed back. The trigger-happy Zionists shot and killed two Palestinian civilians protesting the Zionist regime's raid into their village. While attacks on Jenin are continuing, Zionist settlers have also intensified their provocations at Al-Aqsa Mosque compound. There are fears of serious clashes on the holy compound because of the Zionist regime's provocations.
Afghanistan today.
Part 1.
If you type Afghanistan in Google, you'll come across many military and horrible incidents. In 2020, Afghanistan ranked last on the list of all the countries in the world. This report reveals a bitter reality. The question is, what put Afghanistan in this situation in recent years? Maybe if we go back two decades in time, we can find an answer to our question. 2 decades before 2021 was 2001. Afghanistan's destiny changed that year.
Moments later, the president walked in.
On September 11, 2001, then U.S. President George Bush was visiting a school. His worried face revealed that something concerning had happened. At 8:46 a.m., the first tower was targeted. At 9:03 a.m., the second tower was hit. A major event was unraveling. Four suicide missions with passenger planes in a single day. 9:37 a.m., the Pentagon. 10:03 a.m., an explosion and a plane crash in Pennsylvania. According to Bush, everything was clear and obvious. But was this really the reality?
Who attacked our country? The evidence we have gathered all points to a collection of loosely affiliated terrorist organizations known as Al-Qaeda. This group and its leader, a person named Osama bin Laden.
Bob Graham, former governor of Florida, and the head of the 9/11 fact-finding commission. The commission made a detailed report on the terrorist attacks in 2003. Parts of the report were published. It's known as the 28-page document. The role of Saudi Arabia and the Bush administration was a fact Bob Graham and his colleagues highlighted.
The release of the 28 pages received a variety of interpretations. There were some who said that this confirmed the Saudi link to the 9/11 hijackers. Did these 19 people, most of whom did not speak English, most of whom had never been in the United States before, most of whom were not well educated, did they carry out this sophisticated task alone, or did they have some form of support while they were in the United States? If the answer is they had some support, who provided that support?
A hidden network that spread from Riyadh
to the White House. At the head of the network, there was a Saudi man named Bandar bin Sultan.